Most students will head back to school in August, but how will schools protect them? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, what precautions would make you as a parent most comfortable to send your kid back to school this fall? We'll take a look at a survey that's being asked of you right now. It's 549-2937. Then later, how Asian Americans in Florida are fighting racist attacks in this pandemic. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis. Let's begin with the numbers. Statewide, the Florida Department of Health reports 47,471 cases. That's a jump of 527 in 24 hours. There are 2,096 deaths in Florida, 44 more than reported yesterday. In Northeast Florida, we stand at 2,132 cases and 73 deaths. Now, amidst these climbing numbers, an update for you. The city of Jacksonville has announced its drive-through coronavirus testing site at the downtown Prime Osborne Convention Center has ceased operations. The city says people have access to testing at other public sites around town, including a TIAA Bankfields Lot J, and dozens of private medical facilities. So be in mind of that Prime Osborne testing site has shut down. Meanwhile, the state has approved a plan to resume the operation of vacation rentals in Duval, St. John's, and Nassau counties. That's another aspect of the state's reopening. And amidst the climbing coronavirus numbers, the school year is wrapping up. How has that been going at your house? Probably about as well as can be expected, right? I think we're all looking to summer break. But here's a question. What can we expect from our area schools when kids go back into school buildings in just a few months, in August? Duval County Public Schools has put a survey out in the field to get a sense of what parents and teachers want and students. Emily Block covers education for the Florida Times Union. She's been covering this in the paper, and she's on the phone right now. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
So good to have you on the show once again. And here's our question to callers. What types of measures would make you feel comfortable sending your child back to school in the fall? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Well, Emily, the Centers for Disease Control has put out a document outlining its recommendations for how to reopen schools during this coronavirus pandemic. And as we're learning about the federal guidelines, local school districts are trying to get a handle on this, beginning with this survey that they've sent out to people who have an interest. What are they asking everybody?
Right. So a lot of what's going to happen next school year is still really ambiguous. No one's completely sure what that's going to look like. So Duval School sent out a survey for a wide group of people. They sent it for teachers, for students, for family members, and then also for the general public. They're separate surveys. And they're asking, each one is asking people to indicate how comfortable they feel, how safe they feel, and then goes through a few different varieties. So how safe do you feel if everyone wears a mask? How safe do you feel if there's regular hand washing? How safe would you feel if there were barriers to enforce social distancing and things of that nature?
The school board, the Duval County School Board, approved the purchasing of masks this week. Is that right?
Correct.
So how many masks are they buying and who will be wearing them?
So it is 100,000 masks, and they would be for teachers, for students, and then K through five students get a different kind of mask. It's kind of smaller and doesn't have as strong of a filter. We don't know the restrictions yet or the rules or really if those will be mandated. It's more a precaution to have them when they need them if they do.
That's the big question, isn't it? Would the schools mandate that students and teachers wear masks when they return to school? And already, you know, there's been such a pushback, at least in some quarters, to mandating mask wearing. Would that be seen by some parents as an overreach? Would that, you know, would they just encourage mask wearing rather than mandating it?
Right. It's a possibility. And it's something they touch on a little bit in the survey. How comfortable do you feel wearing a mask every day? Should it be enforced? And that's something I'm hearing a lot of teachers speak out about as well. Some are saying, well, yeah, we need these precautions, but others are saying, how you try teaching with a mask on for, you know, an 8-hour
day.
What does that look like? Exactly. They're, you know, they're hot, they fog up your glasses. Some teachers are working with students that need more inflection, and you know, it's complicated. And I think everyone knows that.
It's 549-2937 as we speak with education reporter Emily Block of the Times Union. How would you feel most comfortable sending your child back to school this fall? Will you decide not to? Give us a call. And this survey is open through the last day of school, May 29th, for Duval County Public Schools, parents, teachers, educators, students. Another thing they're continuing to ask people about, Emily, is when kids go back to class in August, they might be having a different schedule, staggered school days, so as to lessen the population inside schools. How would that look?
Yes, it's not completely clear how that would look. Something they've touched on is, yes, staggered school days. Another thing that's touched on is potentially delaying the start of the school year, which right now is set for August 10th. It's not, there hasn't been a clear plan to what that would look like yet, as far as I can tell.
But, you know, all of these changes that they're contemplating could really bring about, in particular, the staggered school days, bring about a different educational experience for particularly high school students who have long chafed under the high school schedule. This could give some students more freedom, more flexibility. They could do more work from home. They'd be a little bit more almost like a college student than a traditional high school student, wouldn't they, if some of these changes get approved?
Exactly. There are pros and cons to all of this, and I think a lot of people are realizing that. There are some students that have, and I've covered this in my reporting, there are some students that have completely thrived under virtual school, and there are others that are getting left behind, with the caveat that once we're back in real in-person school, things will kind of level out. But it might take a while to get to that.
Yeah. And here's an email from JD. He's a pediatrician. And he says, I have a concern about surveying parents to see what they think about wearing masks. Most parents don't have enough scientific background to make an informed decision. Use science. Make it mandatory to wear masks in school until a vaccine is developed. We don't need any more sick kids or dead ones because of an uninformed decision by parents. Let's talk about the fact, Emily, that paramount among all of these decisions that are being made by local school superintendents is keeping the students and the teachers safe. Kids are less likely to get COVID-19. They're more likely to just be an asymptomatic carrier of the disease, but some children have gotten sick and some have died. What about this take from a local pediatrician that we shouldn't be leaving this up to a survey and what parents think? The superintendents have to balance the perceptions and priorities of the parents and teachers out there with the science behind this.
Absolutely. And my understanding is that the school district, and again, I don't speak for them, I'm reporting on what they do, but my understanding is that the survey is just one piece of it. They're also looking at science. They're looking at what the state and federal regulations are going to be. And those aren't clear yet either. So this is just one factor to try and get an idea of where people's heads are at.
And the survey is live at DuvalSchools.org, correct, through the last day of school, which is May 29th.
Yes. Exactly.
St. John's County put a survey out in April asking some similar questions. And whether you're in St. John's, Duval, Nassau counties, anywhere around the area, we want you to call us up, because right now we're getting ready to let kids out of virtual school for the summer. Yay! There will be much rejoicing. Yes, there will be much rejoicing at my house. I can tell you that right now, with two teenage girls at home who have struggled with virtual school. But summer break will be over before you know it. And as we just learned from Emily Block of the Times Union, school is, at least right now, scheduled to go back in Duval County on August 10th. How is that going to look? What would make you comfortable with sending your student back to school? Or would you feel uncomfortable? Would you perhaps keep them at home in the fall? We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Give us a call. Now, Emily Block, if parents don't feel that the decisions school districts make are adequate, what options will they have to continue distance learning for their children?
So there's a possibility that the school district may see that there's a large pattern of parents that don't feel comfortable going back to school, and even teachers. So there's potential that maybe a hybrid school model or Duval Homeroom, which is their online learning platform, will continue. They've also mentioned through emails to families that if their child is thriving in online school, or it's a matter of health safety that they're more susceptible, or there's a family member that's more susceptible to catching the coronavirus, that they can look into enrolling them into virtual school full time. So Duval has a virtual academy. It's not Duval Homeroom, which is basically this substitute for in-person learning. It is an actual virtual school that they would transfer their enrollment to, and they can opt for that. And that's something the district has encouraged looking into.
Okay, let's go to some calls for Emily Block. She covers education for the Florida Times Union. And here's our question to callers. What measures would make you feel comfortable sending your student back to school in August? Local school districts are trying to figure out how they're going to handle that right now. If you go to DuvalSchools.org, you can participate in a survey letting the district know what types of measures you'd like to see in school buildings in August to keep students and teachers and everybody there safe from spread of COVID-19. It's 549-2937. Let's begin with Diana. Hey, Diana. Good morning.
Hey. Good morning. I went to Cherry Parker, graduated in the early 70s when we had double sessions because of overcrowding right before Sandalwood opened. And we did fine. I was a senior. I went to school in the morning. The other half of the class went in the afternoon. I went to the University of Florida, and I did okay.
You did just fine. Excellent. Thank you, Diana. So Emily, particularly for, I would guess, the upper grades in the fall, they might be given the option to just go a half a day and then study at home the rest of the day. They'd be on the honors system, of course. They'd be expected to work independently. That's possible, right?
Yes, that's something that's being considered. I don't know if it would necessarily be half a day or if it would be like an A day, B day, like one day on, one day off or something like that. Not totally clear what the plan would be, but it is something that's being considered, not just in Duval schools, but I think statewide and even nationwide.
And have superintendents given any sense to you about how important the parental and teacher survey will be in how they make the decisions? How much weight will these surveys really carry?
They're really pushing for people to fill them out, especially Superintendent Diana Green sent a note to teachers, which she's been doing every week since distance learning started. She sends a very personalized note on Fridays, just kind of catching everyone up with how she's feeling, how are they doing, checking in. And she's strongly suggested that teachers fill this out. And something worth noting is that this is an online survey, an anonymous survey. Regardless of if it's a student filling it out, a parent filling it out, or a teacher filling out. So they really want them to air all of their grievances, people that fill this out, and let them know what's going on in their head.
The airing of grievances. I'm sure they'll appreciate that. No feats of strength, though, I don't think, on this survey. A little Festivus joke for you. Kristen is in Arlington. Hi, Kristen. Go ahead.
Good morning, Melissa. My question is, schools are a haven of germs. Students are always sick. Teachers are always sick. How could you possibly distinguish between a common cold, maybe the flu, and COVID on any given day? You have dozens of people sick at a school.
Yeah, that's the concern I have too, Kristen, as a parent of two high school students that we'll be having. Schools are a hotbed of germs. Emily, how, even if they clean and disinfect constantly, socially distance, encourage mask wearing, you still got hundreds of kids milling around in enclosed spaces.
Right. A lot of that comes back to the need for more tests, more coronavirus testing, rapid testing, and even antibody tests. And it's something that the statewide superintendents guild, or I forget their proper term, but it's a collective of all the state superintendents. And in their advisory, they said that there would be a need for coronavirus testing in mass. There would have to be weekly tests of students, temperature checks daily, things of that nature, to make sure that this isn't just a hotbed culminating and making things worse. Something else that they suggest in their letter was rethinking what things like recess, mass gatherings like school lunches in the cafeteria and things of that nature look like. And they said in their letter, if those things can't be done, if testing can't be done regularly, if some of these things can't be reimagined, then maybe we need to stay home and continue virtual school.
Mm. Oh, man. How will that announcement be met? If parents have to begin a new school term with more virtual school, it's basically been like 2 months of Chinese water torture for all of us. At least for me, trying to communicate with teachers, communicate with my students at home, get them to do at least some of their homework virtually. About that? How's that going to go over?
It's a really hard adjustment. I think everyone's learning as we go. Something that's worth noting, though, is that this has never been done before. So in theory, hopefully, it will get easier. Something that State Department of Education Chair Richard Corcoran had mentioned in a prior meeting was that we've never done this before. So now that we have, we can't just forget how it works. So maybe there needs to be some muscle memory. Maybe even when the school year is completely back to normal and everyone is back in classes and everything looks completely traditional, maybe there still needs to be, instead of like a early release day or a planning day, maybe there needs to be like one virtual day quarterly where people kind of flex that muscle memory and remember what online schooling looks like. So in case there is a situation like this ever again, it's not such a hard pivot to learn from scratch again.
It is. Yeah, it is incredible how quickly they had to ramp this up. 549-2937. Shara in Clay County. Shara, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Great, thanks. So you're a teacher? And what are your thoughts about
a junior high teacher in Clay County?
A junior high teacher in Clay. So how would you like to see your school handle all of this?
So I've been flourishing in the virtual world, and so have my two children. I have an 8-year-old, a third grader, and I have a ninth grader, a 15-year-old. And just keeping them on a schedule daily, this time you're going to be doing this class, and this time you're going to be doing this class, and then we're going to go outside, and we're going to have resource, and we're going to have fun, and then we're going to go back to schooling. Virtual schooling has been really great for me. I've done virtual lessons online. I meet with my students virtually online, and they've all enjoyed it. I mean, they really want the contact with the teacher. If we do go back come August, I am totally 100% for wearing a mask. I have no problem giving a lesson for 7.5 hours a day with a mask, as long as it's keeping, you know, other teachers safe as well as my students safe, because that's of the utmost priority.
Do you think your fellow teachers would feel the same way? And would some of the students feel like it's just not cool for me to wear a mask? Would there be peer pressure around wearing or not wearing a mask?
I think if it's mandated, like right now, we mandated this year that they had to wear a student ID. And there were hiccups with that, but eventually they all started wearing their student ID around their neck. I think it would be something similar to that, that there's always going to be hiccups when you first institute something. But if it's mandated, then it's a priority, and the students know the rationale behind why they're doing something and that it's for the safety of them and their fellow classmates and their teachers, I don't see that being an issue.
All right, Shara. Well, best wishes to you as the school year begins in a few months. Thanks for your call. That's Shara, a junior high teacher in Clay County, Emily. And, you know, have you talked to some other teachers, other students? What kind of feedback are they giving you? Is it similar to what she said?
Yeah. So as far as masks go, a comparison I've heard a lot, actually, is student IDs. But it's kind of a mixed bag. Like in Shara's opinion, well, yeah, there are some hiccups and it'll come around. And other teachers, maybe some are just a little more cynical, are saying, well, yeah, you see how IDs are going, which is telling me that it's not going well. So I think it's the school by school and nailing down that this is a mandate and why it is a mandate. But it's definitely a mixed bag of emotions. Every teacher has different opinions, just like every person has different opinions. And I think there's a lot of added pressure, of course, this school year. So.
We did speak on the show yesterday with the founder of this global movement called Masks for All, and he pointed out that to stop COVID in any population, you need at least 80% of the group to be consistently wearing masks.
Yeah, so, it's also just a gesture of kindness. I know that I have my mask. And I've been making sure to have it ready in case there is a press conference or something that I have to attend in person. I know that a lot of my reporter peers are doing the same, and it's frustrating when we see public officials that are not doing the same. Not to say all of them. I know a lot of ours have been great about it, but it's something that everyone has to get on board with if it's going to work.
Comments on our Facebook page about this. Aaron writes, kids should be allowed to wear a mask in school if they want to. I'm sure this will be a bullying opportunity for other kids. Sad to say it's been like that after the stay-at-home orders and hearing their parents talk about it in a negative light. Emily writes, this is similar to after 9/11. Things are going to change. I can't understand parents who want everything back to normal. It makes no sense to me that people wouldn't want to follow science and safety, she says. And as we speak with education reporter Emily Block of the Times Union, lots of calls as we learn about how school systems around the state are figuring out the proper social distancing and cleaning measures and possible mask wearing to keep students safe when they go back to campus in the fall. School is almost out for the summer, but they're already planning ahead for the fall. And we want to know what would make you feel most comfortable. What decisions would you like to see your student school make? 549-2937. Daryl in St. Augustine. Hi, Daryl.
Hey, good morning, Melissa.
Hey.
Just wanted to let, it's not true quite that this has never been done before. My sister and her husband have been teaching virtual classes, French immersion and geometry algebra, two students in Western Canada for over 10 years.
Hmm.
And their students are some of the best prepared and appreciated by professors at colleges. They do have a graduation at the end of the year. So this is being done in other countries. They do it there primarily because it's such a long drive to a school in some areas on a bus. You're talking 2 hours there, 2 hours back. They spend three of those hours or two of those hours actually studying and doing work. So there are programs out there and experienced teachers out there
mm-hmm.
in other locations. It's just the pandemic has forced us to do that.
Yeah, I mean, we've had to learn this overnight, many, many households, and it's been a learning curve for sure, Daryl. And I'm sure other countries, other places around the world have more ease with this. Here's an email from Andrew. The Duval virtual classroom has many serious problems. It's hard to navigate, hard to find and complete assignments, hard to contact the teacher, but easy to lose hours of work. If this is the way of the future, it needs some adjusting. Emily, what kinds of reviews have you been getting from parents and kids and teachers about the virtual setup that had to be constructed so rapidly when the pandemic hit, and that I'm sure we'll see some continuation of when school begins in August?
Yeah, I did a whole story about this actually, and it talks about some of the downsides of Duval Homeroom and some of the issues there. It also talks about the bright spots and what I'm hearing from students. The good that I'm hearing from students and parents is the freedom, the flexibility. Their students are finishing their schoolwork by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and then they go and get to hang out or do whatever they want. And they're loving that flexibility to jump from class to class, from assignment to assignment. Some of the harder sticking points have been things like every teacher is doing it differently because, again, this platform was set up so quickly. They had about like 3 days, and that included a weekend to figure everything out. So they did what they could. I've heard that compared to other school districts and seen data-wise that it's a lot cleaner than other districts are handling it. But there are still issues as far as some teachers, like I said, it depends on the teacher, how the class will look. So there's a bunch of different online platforms that a student has to sign up and log into. So there's no uniformity.
There's no uniformity. Yes, that has been my experience in trying to help my youngest through this. Each teacher has a different way of doing things, a different setup, a different method for sending in work, a different way of taking attendance. It took several weeks just to figure that out.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I would agree with you that the lack of uniformity has been a challenge.
I had one student that told me he felt like he was being grounded for life, that he had more homework than ever, that that it was more homework than ever, that attendance was inconsistent, and he didn't know where to go. And you'll see in that story that I did, I highlight all of that, and we actually bring those concerns from students to the district. And then that week, Superintendent Green sent out a note to teachers saying, like, hey, remember that, like, we're all human, yourselves as teachers, but also our students. And let's, you know, not be crazy about workloads. Let's be mindful of screen time and things like that.
Yeah. Let's take one more call. It's John in St. Augustine. Hi, John.
Hi, Melissa. How are you doing?
Okay.
I'm taking a little different point of view of this. I taught high school in Ohio for 32 years, moved here 20 years ago, and started as a volunteer with the Model United Nations at one of the high schools here, and now as a student council. The concern I have, and I don't know the answer, in my mind, a good part of school is experiential. If kids are to learn to be leaders, they have to have an opportunity to lead, like student council, interacting with other kids, which is face-to-face. And by the way, the kids that I've talked to that are in my group, because I call them once a week, don't particularly care for the virtual aspect of it for the obvious reason. School is a, like I said, experiential as well as academic, and I feel we're losing a lot by virtual education only. That said, I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, exactly right, John. Emily, your final thoughts there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are kids. They miss their friends. They miss hanging out. They miss these experiences like sports and band and theater that were canceled, by the way. These are things that these students are working a whole school year for, whether it's a play or whether it's the band competition or, you know, sports. And they got canceled. So we'll never know how those went. And that's so disheartening for a student. At the same time, there are some bright spots. I interviewed student journalists this past week on how they're still running their high school papers, but now from home instead of in-person meeting. They're doing Teams meetings and Google Hangouts and figuring out how to put a paper out, much like the professionals are, by the way. And they've completely pivoted their coverage. They're covering the coronavirus and how it's affecting students and teachers and parents and families and students working part-time jobs at Publix and things like that. So they're rolling with it and making the best out of it. And I think we're going to see more of that, more online meetings. I know I've seen Gay Straight Alliance's GSA's meeting online and doing Instagram updates and things like that. So if there was ever a generation to handle this, it would be Gen Z. So I do have some optimism there, but it's a new normal. I hate that phrase, but it's true. It's
it really is.
What this is all going to look like, and it's not going to be the same.
It's lots of change, but you're right. These kids can handle it with a few hiccups along the way. In the meantime, I want everyone to go to DuvalSchools.org, fill out that survey. I'm going to do the same. And I want to thank you for your great coverage, as always, Emily Block of the Times Union. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Much more still ahead later, how you can enjoy this area's best food trucks this weekend while still socially distanced. But up next.
Just like everybody else, you're feared and frustrated. The racism that we face, it's kind of out of the blue.
Why Asian Americans are fearful in this pandemic and what they're doing about it. That's after this.
Miles, Herbie, Monk. They're all part of Jazz Festival Weekend. 3 days of jazz on TV, radio, streaming, and online. It's Jazz Festival Weekend on the Jacksonville Music Experience. Full lineup at wjct.org/jacksmusic.
The Voidcast from WJCT is a musical journey through Northeast Florida. I'm the host, Void Magazine editor Matt Shaw. Join me while I cut through the digital noise to share handpicked local music stories. WJCT.org/Voidcast.
Electro Lounge can now be heard Monday through Fridays at 10 p.m. till midnight and Saturdays from 9 to 11. Join us at the Electro Lounge only on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. There is a move afoot to create more oversight into JEA, not just that federal investigation into the utility, but also the bonuses they hand out to employees. Here's City Councilman Ron Salem. Councilman Ron Salem, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about this bill you filed that would give the City Council more oversight into those JEA bonuses. Those have been controversial for a long time. What would this measure do?
Melissa, this particular bonus program is the short-term incentive plan, which is a yearly plan that's been in place since 1990. It was not paid for 3 years during the Great Recession, but has been paid virtually every year since then. It costs JEA anywhere from $4 to $7 million. It's paid to the senior leadership team, the appointed staff, and the union staff. So all 2,000 employees get a piece of this, and it increases as you move up to the leadership team. I got concerned with this plan as I began investigating the long-term incentive plan, or PUP, in December of 2019. Uncovered this plan, have done a lot of research on this, and I have several concerns. One, in the last 3 years, the JEA board has given authority to the CEO over all of compensation, so that the CEO could design this plan and essentially pay himself off this plan. In January of 19, the JEA board gave that authority to Aaron Zahn, and he received $31,000 in October from this plan. In December of 17, the board gave the authority over compensation to Paul McElroy. This was before he left and Aaron Zahn became the CEO. That's one of my big concerns. Another concern I have is when the JEA submits their budget to the City of Jacksonville to be approved by the City Council, this incentive plan has never been included in their budget. When we questioned why it was not included, the response was, if we save money in our plan, then we pay out the budget. I'm not comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm. So would this measure give you oversight over whether they could pay bonuses at all, or would you just be able to see the bonuses in the budget? What would this legislation actually do?
What this legislation requires is that if the JEA wants to pay a budget, I mean, it wants to pay a bonus, the board has to approve it. Number one, it comes to the City Council in the form of an ordinance with this specific bonus plan. We would then provide that plan to our council auditors to review it to make sure it was an appropriate plan, the incentives they were laying out were achievable.
Layer of oversight that they don't currently have. And
that is correct.
And would this would have to go before the voters ultimately, wouldn't it?
That's correct. Because we're changing the authority outside of JEA to the City Council, the voters would have to approve giving that authority to the City Council versus leaving it within the JEA, and that would require a referendum if the City Council passes my bill, and it would go on the November ballot.
This is getting its first reading. You're on the Finance Committee. How much support do you think this has?
Well, I think a lot of people think that the plan needs significantly more oversight. The issue are there are some council members that believe that it's an authority and we ought to leave the authority alone and let them handle it. It is my feeling I don't want to get in anybody's sandbox unless they misbehave. And I think the JEA has mishandled this plan in recent years, and I think additional oversight then is required, and I think the city council is the place to do it. I have a short-term incentive plan in my regular job. I have a long-term incentive plan. I'm not opposed to bonuses, but I think bonuses require a lot more scrutiny than they're presently getting.
Do you think they should be abolished altogether at the utility?
I do not. I do not. I think if that entity can show me and the council they can save us $20 or $25 million through innovative type services, to pay them $4 or $5 million, I'm not opposed to.
Well, thanks for your time. We'll follow it. We appreciate you being with us.
Nope. Thank you, Melissa.
Well, Asian Americans have seen a spike in racist attacks amidst the COVID pandemic. Local restaurateur Wen Rady owns the House of Leaf and Bean at Beach in San Pablo. Great place. And she's part of a national effort this month. It's Asian American Pacific Islanders Heritage Month. She's trying to raise awareness about this. I spoke with her. Let's listen. Wen Rady, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You're a wonderful chef and restaurateur. I love your place. It's House of Leaf and Bean on Beach Boulevard. You are now involved with an effort to combat the racism that Asian Americans in this country have been experiencing since the pandemic hit. What are you up to? What are you working on?
All right. So since the pandemic, our community, Asian American community, especially Chinese community, just like everybody else, you're feared and frustrated. But the racism that we face, it's kind of out of the blue, but we combat with this kind of attacks or the instance that we are facing harassment. We combat this with our compassion and love. We have been raising funds to donate to PPEs. And lately, we are joining the national effort called Food of Love. So the rationale behind is that we have a lot of Chinese restaurants around the country. All of them make amazing food. So we would like to take advantage of this to celebrate AAPI Heritage Month. And we chose that last weekend is May 9th and 10th. It's for the historical significance. It's a celebration of completion, Transcontinental Railroad. And we all know that our early Chinese immigrants helped to build the railroad. So we feel like this is a good, significant day for all of us to celebrate through our food of love. For me as an entrepreneur and small business in Jacksonville, we've been doing all this since March. We are contributing and donating complimentary lunches to frontline workers and working in the hospital. Lately, we are working with UF Health downtown campus. So far, we have been donating more than 200 lunches and freshly made from our cafe. Especially like in last month, we have been closed, but our staff was happily to come back to make the fresh meals for our frontline heroes.
Now, a minute ago, you mentioned that racism you've been experiencing is out of the blue. What kinds of things have been happening to you or friends of colleagues of yours?
So not specifically my colleagues or friends in Jacksonville, more of, you know, around the country. When we heard the news, since March, there are more than 1,500 incidents happening around the country, especially more in like hotspot in New York and California and some Houston area. So when we heard that, you know, we are all connected, right? We feared. A lot of them, I know that a lot of my friends buying guns to protect their families. That, when I hear all those things going on, just make me feel like we got to do something. We got to be being better in this country. We are all Americans. This is our home, our country. We love our community. We are contributing through our means. We are making a difference every day.
You certainly are. And I want to ask you, too, as a restaurant owner, what has this crisis been like for you, and what are your plans to open back up to customers?
Recovery will be very slow. But, we are really upbeat and inspired by a lot of other small business. And they are so overwhelming and supportive. We often get a phone call, and just out of blue, we don't even know who they are. They just say, hey, I just wanted to say hi and make sure you're okay, and then you will come back and open up again. And just like today, we just have two visitors out of blue. One is Dr. Phil, and he has a chiropractic in Southside. So I just wanted to purchase a $110 gift card, and then you give it to first 11 people, and everyone come here to purchase from you, and then you give them $10 off. And so that kind of support, it's really overwhelming. It makes us feel like we are doing something right in the community.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't say enough good things about your place. I encourage everyone to check out The House of Leaf and Bean, delicious, organic, healthy, wonderful food. And they are at Beach and San Pablo. Such a great place. And Wen Reiti, I love your energy. I love this effort. I want to thank you for highlighting this during this month where we honor the heritage of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
It is Asian American and Pacific Islanders Heritage Month. Hate crimes against Asians have surged due to coronavirus, but there is a lot of positive news out there, as we heard from Wen. And you can follow the hashtag on social media, UnapologeticallyAsian, for a little bit more discussion about this. A quick break, and up next, it's a food truck roundup at the beaches this weekend. Socially distanced, of course. It's your chance to enjoy some of this area's best local cuisine. We will find out more in just a moment here on First Coast Connect. Don't go away.
Cavendish Partners PA and Michael Cavendish, a law practice supporting Jacksonville's business community, downtown, by appointment, and on the web at cavpartners.com.
Lockdown got you down? Anthology is the right station for you. Over 2,000 songs from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Anthology is bound to stir up memories. Download the WJCT app or visit wjct.org/jacksmusic to start listening today.
For couples working at home during the pandemic, home is also the office. For those with kids, it's the school, too. For many families, the experience is highlighting gender inequities in housework and parenting. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Brenda Schulte, director of the Better Life Lab, a work-life gender equity and social policy program at the think tank New America. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
As the nation tries to reopen, more people are getting tested to see if they've developed antibodies to the coronavirus. Some health experts worry the results will give people a false sense of security.
My fear is we're going to be used as this sort of golden ticket to demonstrate immunity when we just don't know that that's the case.
The pros and cons of antibody testing this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Since Tara Reid went public with her allegations against Joe Biden, various accounts have emerged. He says it never happened, but fresh details are complicating an already complicated picture. I'm Celeste Headlee. What does all of it mean for his future VP pick, the Me Too movement, and Biden's push to beat Donald Trump in November? That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's your chance to enjoy some of this area's best local food trucks this weekend. And of course, you will still practice social distancing. Jeff Klotz is CEO of the Klotz Companies, and he's on the line with more. Hey, Jeff, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. So it's a big food truck rally coming up this Saturday on Mayport Road. Tell us all about this. What's going to be happening?
Well, we for the last several weeks, we've been getting together with a group of food trucks on Mayport Road as part of the socially distanced food truck roundup, which was really a result of a lot of our residents in the community coming out, crying out for a source of quality food and beverage during, I guess, this time in need. And so we've got nine trucks attending this Saturday. And along with a handful of other vendors, which include some local artists and some other folks. And so we're slowly and steadily building up momentum. We started about 4 weeks ago, and it's part of a larger concept, which was permitted and approved by the city to create really a giant outdoor, artisanally, culturally focused food hall and cooperative concept on this particular property. But because of the shutdown and everything else that's going on, we decided just to try to slowly launch just the food truck portion of the project.
Okay, so not a traditional food hall. Everybody will be outside. The trucks will be parked at least 6 feet apart. You'll encourage people coming out to observe those social distance markers you'll place on the ground. But people can still enjoy some community and some local cooking, sounds like.
Of course. So far, it feels like it's been a great hit. We've had several hundred folks out every weekend. The site's a giant site, and so there's plenty of room to be socially distanced. And I think so far, everyone understands the need and has pretty much complied with the requirements. And it's been a big hit. It's been a big success so far. We're really excited.
You'll have some other fun activities, too, for kids, like hula hooping, things they can do. Now, once we get through this crisis, whenever we do, you have some other plans in mind for your project at 1800 Mayport. Can you tell us more?
We do. And so once the crisis is over and once the businesses begin to open up and the city opens back up, we intend to move forward with the original plans, which were approved earlier this year by the City of Atlantic Beach, which really include a combination of both indoor and outdoor food, beverage, dining, nightlife, and entertainment. And so you've got some permanent food vendors, as many as 20 permanent food vendors on the outside, and as many as a half dozen food vendors on the inside, which include businesses like breweries and distilleries, coffee shops. We're implementing a farmer's market, which should be opened 5 to 7 days a week. We've also have some co-working and co-living space planned, along with a couple of amphitheaters or outdoor stages, a commissary kitchen, and a few other facilities as well.
So this pandemic has obviously thrown a massive kink into all of your plans. Have you been able to stay afloat financially through this? How have you dealt with all of those disruptions?
Well, our primary business is real estate and real estate development. We own a portfolio of apartment communities, and so we've got about 20,000 residents, which we're responsible for. And so I think financially we've survived. It hasn't been easy. I don't think it's been easy for anybody, but we've learned a lot. And I think, if anything, it's brought us closer together with our residents. And as a result of really just a better understanding what they need, that's what prompted us to start the socially distanced food truck roundup.
What have you mostly learned? What's the biggest thing you've learned?
Well, I think that, the biggest thing that I've learned personally is that our residents at our communities count on us more for more than just a shelter, a roof over their head, and maybe some amenities. And so we've really learned how to support them in times of need. And I think that that's built much stronger, tighter, closer relationships with them. And I think that's pretty important.
So whether you're a resident or not, you can come out Saturday to the socially distant food truck roundup. This is at 1800 Mayport Road in Atlantic Beach. 9 different food trucks, all local, will be serving up delicious food. This kicks off at 11 a.m., so come on out and enjoy it. And I want to thank you so much for joining us, Jeff. He's Jeff Klotz, CEO of the Klotz Companies, and they are sponsoring this weekly food truck roundup for the beaches. Have fun, Jeff.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And that is our show. Thanks for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers as well. Heather Schatz loves a good food truck meal. She's our producer from her bunker out at the beach, where she's been socially distancing throughout this whole time. But in studio with me is our main man, Josh Torres, show director, along with our news director, Jessica Palumbo. She works remotely, but Bill Bortsfield's been coming in a bit more lately. It's good to see his face, our digital editor. And you are the biggest part of what we do. Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything from today's show, you can find the podcast on our website or wherever you find your podcasts. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for being with us. We'll connect with you again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.